Viola Williams, Wheel 24.
And the... You see, you immediately got that conflict between the North and the South right from the beginning. And they had a 17-year war, which had been nasty, but rather to some extent desultory. It had been aggravated by the fact that Idi Amin in Uganda had caused a great many refugees to come over into Sudan, and so South Sudan was having to some extent some help from overseas organizations to deal with the refugees from Uganda. And at the moment you get overseas aid, there's always conflict if there's two different setups. And this war had been going on for a very long time. I remember talking to a woman quite soon after I got out there, an African Sudanese, and we were talking about the war, and she said, "It's absolutely wonderful. I've been sleeping in my own bed for 2 years, and it doesn't half bring it home to you when you get something like that." And the South was trying to get itself together again, to get itself economically sound, and to get itself not only economically sound, but mentally. And again, I kept bringing up this word of pride, to get in the sort of feeling that they had an identity, that they were not being wiped off the face by the Muslim North, but that they had their own identity, and they wanted to try and see if they could develop that. The Sudanese Christian Council, which had just sort of got cracking again all over. They were the people who asked the World Y if they could send somebody out to try and start YWCAs in Sudan. And nobody knew very much about the Sudan. I mean, nobody had very much contact with it, not as far as we were concerned. And so I went out very much into the blue. I did join up with one of the, I can't remember the one of the NGOs that was there, but I was chiefly under the Sudanese Council of Churches, and they put me up in Juba, because I went down to Juba because that, being the sort of centre of the Christian era, the Christian side of Sudan, that was the most likely place to be able to start a YWCA. And I, within 2 days of being there, I realised that there was a National Council of Women of Sudan, which was the government organ. And that no way was a voluntary organisation of women going to be able to set itself up. We hadn't got a hope in hell. It was a very good idea. But I think my first letter back to Geneva was to say that, as far as I could see, there was no chance of setting up a YWCA. But that I did see that there was quite a lot of work that could be done if they didn't mind my staying down there on their salary, and not specifically to start a YWCA. And I went out to three different areas and worked with the local women. They were not organised, except in one area where it was very strong, National Council of Women. They managed to get back there. But the others were not organised women, and it was a chance to sort of try and get them at least community minded, because the war had split them up so much that there was very little sort of sense of community in the villages, as far as I could see, and I was able to get quite a lot of help from the Lutherans. The Lutherans had got a tremendous amount of material that they got out from the overseas, the home Lutheran organisations, and they weren't in a position to use it. A lot of particularly things like sewing materials and knitting materials and household materials. And the Lutherans were they seemed to be very pleased to let me have more or less whatever I wanted to go out into the villages and work with the villages with that. But the poverty in those villages, and of course there was still, this sounds incredible in this day and age, but there were still parts of Sudan that had never been surveyed. Yes, that on the map was just blank. I mean, it was, you wouldn't believe it, would you? But I found the women were very responsive, but the war, they probably weren't well off anyway, and the war had just left so many of them in absolute abject poverty. I went to one village that they said they would like somebody to go and help them with cooking. And I went out there, and whenever I would do a cookery demonstration anywhere in the world, the first thing I do is go to the local market to see what they've got. I mean, it's no good my going in and saying, well, you can use this which comes from America. You've got to be able to use what they've got themselves. And so in this particular village, I went to the market, or the so-called market, to see what they've got. And in the whole of the market, there were two onions. And that was what I was doing a cookery course. It was because that was all they got, and you had to sort of charge down and see what else there was actually available in any of the houses, any of the holdings or anything anywhere in the village. And finally, we did it. We had some absolutely uproarious classes. They had a little bunch of discrete leaves in the right place. They didn't speak anything that I spoke. I didn't speak anything that they spoke. I had not been interpreter. And we had uproarious classes on it. Whether they learned anything or not, I don't know. But I do know that they enjoyed themselves. And in a country like Sudan, as it was then, anything that they could enjoy was a little bonus. There was a tremendous amount of rehabilitation going on. A lot of it local rehabilitation, where they were trying to rethatch their little houses and get some education going, trying to get some medical assistance going. There was a frightfully good, he was a silly old soul, but he was a very good agriculturalist, and he'd got a little island in the Nile where he was doing a tremendous agricultural program, and it really was a good program. I used to go over quite often to see him boat over to his little island, and he was spreading what he was doing there. He was managing to spread it along the banks of the Nile. And one of the this this one of the bits that was rehabilitating them after the war, and this to us today anyway sounds awful, was that one of their chief sources of income was wild animals for the chipper fields. And I went up to, because I had contacts with the chipper fields, because they used to live in Amesbury, and we used to live in Amesbury, and so I got a sort of contact with the chipper fields. And so I went up to have a look and see what was going on there, and that was absolutely fascinating. I mean, they were collecting animals, and they were doing it very well done. I mean, it wasn't brutal or anything, and they were collecting animals, and that was one of the spouse source of income at the time was the license to get to take animals from there.
This would have been for the suckers, would it? Is it a Chipperfield suckers?
Yes, mostly for their circus, yeah. I don't think they ever had a zoo. I think it was mostly for the circus. But they were collecting all sorts of things. So presumably when they brought them back, they were quite likely selling them to other zoos and things. I mean, I'm sure they never had a rhinoceros in their circus. And they certainly had a rhinoceros there the day I was there. So that must have gone somewhere else. Their circus stuff, of course, was all over the country. So I remember meeting all over England, anyway, meeting a tribe of elephants coming down a side road one dawn, with each elephant holding its other's trunk. that was a shock. But they did get some income from it, but there wasn't much else that they could get income from, because the Dinkas, which is a chief tribe in the south, are the pastoralists with cattle and moving around with cattle. They hadn't got a tremendous lot of outside income coming into them. It was more or less if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours in the actual bit of country. But they were nice people, but then I went back to Geneva, and after I was there about 3 months doing work with the women, and then I went back to Geneva, and then by this time one of the other organisations, which had its base in England, had heard about what I was doing with the women, and they asked the why if I could go back with their organisation back into Sudan, because they wanted to start a rural training centre in one of the most sort of sad areas, to try and help both the men and the women with food production, food utilisation, and ultimately food selling. So that it was a sort of thing. And they said, would I go back and set up the women's side of it?
What organisation was that you went back with? Or not, if you can't remember, Viola, you've remembered so much, don't worry.
I know I worked with ACROSS, but that was not the organisation that I went up to the Rural Training Centre with.
It was an NGO, obviously.
It was an NGO.
Yes.
And it was an interesting NGO, because there were three of us up there doing this. We started off in tents, and we got a bit more civilised afterwards. But there was a young American, a young, very energetic, very wise. He didn't know much, but he knew he didn't know much, and he was learning all the time. And a German, a young German, who was an absolute pillar of strength. And the three of us just got on like a house on fire. And we gradually got things going. I managed to get some funds to put up a building for the home economics side of it, for the women's side of it. And the men got themselves going on the agricultural side of it, and we got quite a good agricultural set up there, and ultimately I managed to get a YWCA, black YWCA girl, to go out and work with the women on our side of it, on the sort of home economics, using what the men were growing, and the pigs and all that sort of thing, and she was quite good. She asked, she did quite well. She handed over to a local once again, because we got one or two. We got some good local women there. I was there for an election when they were having a general election, a national general election, and the men sealed all the boxes which the women were likely to be able to use. Because we put up a woman in our ward or whatever it was. We put a woman up, and the men weren't going to have that. No way. This was still the deepest Africa. They weren't going to have a woman doing it. But we had some good women, and they took over, and it was beginning to make its way, and then the war broke out again. And because we were working in an area where the two organisations were the churches. They've got a church training centre there, and our rural training centre, and we were working together. And the war just wiped both out, just like that, overnight. The new war. And all the area that had been largely supported by the West was gradually just wiped out by the Arab North. And the poverty down there now is absolutely incredible. And of course it's a forgotten poverty, that's one of the things. But the war is still going on, and because I know I did quite a bit up in Wau while I was there, and Wau was a nice little town, and I think Wau has practically disappeared off the face of the map. I mean, it was they really have tried to wipe out to a large extent the South, and it's been very much a sort of rear guard action, I think. Whether they'll ever get them sorted out or not, I don't know. Whether there'll be sufficient support from it would have to be from the UN to set up a southern state of Sudan and a northern state of Sudan, I don't know, but they're never going to work as a united one. In the same way that there are so many parts of the world today where it's completely divided and they're not going to be able to unite themselves together. I mean, are we ever going to get a peaceful Balkan states? Are we ever going to get a peaceful Middle East? Northern Ireland? Bits of South America? I mean, it's the intolerance everywhere is just absolutely incredible.
Were you involved with the war then, Viola, when it hit your area? You know, do you remember?
No, because I handed over first to our black African, and then they handed over to local black Africans. So I think we were still getting support from one of the American agencies, and I think from one of the English agents, one of the British agencies. But that was support for the whole centre rather than for any specific part of it. And then, as I say, the whole thing just disappeared. And I'd like to go back. I'm too old now, but I wouldn't mind going back and trying to see if it's possible to get something straight again there. Because
it does seem to be a neglected area so far as the media is concerned, yeah. Doesn't it? Yeah. You know, we hear very little about the Sudan.
Well, it's such a lousy country. South Sudan is such a lousy country to get about in. our centre that we set up was 300 miles from Juba, which is the capital of the south, and it was unmade roads. And in the summer you couldn't see for dust, and when the rains came you couldn't get through. And that's it almost wherever you are. If you were near enough to the Nile, you could go up and down the Nile on by boat. I did one or two trips like that, but even that was perilous because nobody ever knew where the sandbanks were going to be because they changed overnight. And you would get stuck on a sandbank for 24, 48 hours without turning a hair. But it's a very, very sad country. I'm sorry for the ordinary people there, because they're the ones who've borne the brunt of the whole thing. The top people have probably lost all their income, or whatever income they were having. But it's the people at village level that really have suffered there, where they've just been moved on and moved on and moved on. And added to which, of course, Sudan's had all the Ethiopian refugees, because they came over in their millions when Ethiopia was a mess. And Sudan, a bitterly poor country, had to deal with all that lot. So it has been a very unhappy country. And I can still see that woman's face. I've sat to my own bed for 2 years. Well, she hasn't since. After I, Khartoum was the sort of place where one had to go to get things done.
This would have been in the north, isn't it?
Yeah, Khartoum there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I will give the UN marks for, and that was that if there was a UN plane going somewhere and they had room on it for me, they would put me on, because travel there. If you try to get on a Sudanese airliner, quite likely the military decided they were going to move that day, and they would take over the plane, and any civilians were just left on the airport. I mean, that's just like that. So when you could get a UN one, you could. They would let you have them, and one or two of the missionaries, the Across people who were based in Nairobi, they also had a plane, and I could use that going back and forwards. But I was up in Khartoum on one occasion, and I went round to UNICEF, because I knew UNICEF had got quite a lot of money, basically for children, of course, but for supporting agencies, supporting work for children. And I went round to them, and an awfully nice young man, I forget, from some obscure country, said, they've got plenty of money. Yes, come up with one or two good projects, and we'll fund them. There's no problem about it at all. And as I said, I mainly concentrated on three villages in the south. And I got three quite good projects in my mind anyway, where they could grow, they could feed, they could do handicrafts, they could sell. And I wanted about £500 for each one of these three. It's no good dealing with a village and going in with £20,000, £30,000, because they just don't understand it. And you've got to work. When you're working with local people, you've got to work at a level that they can understand. And I went back to UNICEF and I said I'd like £500, three lots of £500, to do some work in these three villages. And I outlined what I wanted to do and so on. And the man behind the desk looked at me and he said, £1,500? Oh, no, I can't be bothered with £1,500. We were expecting something like 20,000 or 30,000. We could have dealt with that, but I'm not going to be bothered with 1,500. The amount of paperwork for 1,500 just seems much too much work for him. So we didn't get our £500. And that very much put me off some of the UN agencies. The other bit while I was in Sudan that again put me off a UN agency was I was at our Royal Training Centre up in the wilds, and we were beginning to get our women's side of it organised, the men's side was beginning to get organised. And we had a woman come out, was sent out by the Food and Agriculture Organization based in Rome. And she was British. I'm ashamed to say she was British. And she came out and I don't think she'd ever done any work in that sort of part of the world before. And she came out and she laid down all the things that we ought to be doing. This, that and the other. With no relation to what the local people were able to cope with at all. And I got more and more and more cross with her. And we were sharing accommodation, which didn't help. But I don't very often, when I'm in this country or anywhere else, I don't very often pull rank. She was FAO. I was an NGO, and NGOs were lower than the dirt as far as most of the UN agencies are concerned. And we were talking over supper one night, and with great gusto, she said, and of course, you see, back in Britain, I am a member of the British Home Economics Association. Right. I said, well, of course, I'm an elected fellow of the British Home Economics Association. And I don't think there are very few things in life that have given me as much satisfaction. Because it was true. And I mean, I was about as far above her as the UN was above my NGO. But Sudan was bad. Since then, I don't think I've really done anything in a war-disturbed areas. I've worked in a number of short-term emergency things, but they've not usually been connected with wars. They've usually been more connected with personnel and buildings and that kind of thing, finance. But I think that's about it.
From what you've been saying, you know, the Sudan seemed a very challenging place. Was it one of the most challenging for you?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was the most challenging. Korea was pretty awful, and every time I've gone back to the Middle East, it's been pretty awful. But Sudan, I can almost say Sudan was almost a naive experience. I mean, bits of it were absolutely hilarious. One holiday weekend, we were sitting, some of us were sitting in our little rabbit hutch little rooms. We were sitting out on the balcony. And I was the only white there, the rest were all miscellaneous colours. And a monkey got loose and came up the balcony, and I was the only white skin there, and it bit me. And then one of the Africans leapt to my rescue, and it bit him. And this was on a bank holiday weekend, of course, it always is. And we didn't I didn't know quite what to do about it, but I knew that in not very far from where we were, we had the WHO, the World Health Organization, boss for the whole of the region.